I think the critics often say that originalism, and in turn Justice Thomas being kind of the ultimate originalist, favors the corporation over the consumer, the strong over the weak, the rich over the poor, and the government over the individual. What I would posit is the book proves the opposite is true.
That's federal judge Amul Thapar explaining how he feels Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas has been misunderstood and why he wrote a book, The People's Justice, to defend Thomas's work on the bench. I'm Margaret Hoover. This is the Firing Line Podcast.
Since joining the federal judiciary in 2007, Amul has established a reputation as a keen legal mind who applies the law fairly to all who enter his courtroom.
Thapar is a former federal prosecutor and district court judge who was nominated to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals by President Donald Trump in 2017. He also made Trump's shortlist for the Supreme Court.
It was an incredible honor to go to the White House as the child of immigrants, be appointed three different times by presidents. I mean, only in America can things like this happen.
Following the close of a consequential Supreme Court term in which the conservative majority dismantled affirmative action, Thapar offers context for Thomas's long-held beliefs on the issue.
He's been a champion his whole career for historically black colleges. He grew up himself in the segregated South. He recognizes that blacks can accomplish, under the hardest circumstances imaginable, incredible things.
And as Thomas and his colleagues on the high court face growing questions about ethics and finances, Judge Thapar comes to their defense.
I would challenge on any of those justices, anyone to point out where they've ruled inconsistent with their priors as a result of any of that, and they haven't.
And what if Thapar's own future on the bench?
Justice Thomas is the longest serving Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. Does this book make you a logical candidate to be his successor? Honorable Judge Amul Thapar, welcome to Firing Line.
Thank you for having me.
During your confirmation hearings for the Sixth Circuit, you said that you don't like labels. How do you define your judicial philosophy?
So I think I'm an originalist, but the reason that label isn't perfect is because there's many camps of originalism. So I would say I'm an original public, meaning originalist, and I think that comes right out of the Constitution itself, and I'm happy to explain that, but I don't want to get too in the weeds. But that's the easiest way to say it. So one thing that when you think about the Constitution and who it binds government officials and military. We take an oath to it. So for the American people, the Constitution is the document that governs those who govern all of us. Mm-hmm. And I think when you take an oath to this Constitution, it means the words and concepts contained in that document.
You have a new book. It's called The People's Justice. And it examines the jurisprudence of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. You write, quote, "You will find a justice who cares about the people behind the cases. You will find a justice who does not fit the stereotypes. You will find a justice who always tries his best to follow the original meaning of the Constitution. And you will leave these pages knowing that Justice Clarence Thomas truly is the people's justice." You believe that Justice Thomas is misunderstood.
Yes.
Why?
I think the critics often say that originalism, and in turn Justice Thomas being kind of the ultimate originalist, favors the corporation over the consumer, the strong over the weak, the rich over the poor, and the government over the individual. Mm-hmm. What I would posit is the book proves the opposite is true. It doesn't mean he's always going to rule consistent with those lines, because he will first and foremost follow the law. He will do a couple things. He will follow the law, but he will always remember there's real people involved in the cases. And what you will find in his individual writings, and we can come back to why the book includes all individual writings, but in his individual writings, is he will do that. He will often have a strong black voice, which is never reported. Mm-hmm. And he will talk about the real people involved in the case and the struggles they face.
Give me an example of when you feel he is opined, especially from the book, when you feel he has articulated a strong black voice.
So I think there are many chapters in the book where he does. I think in particular, chapters 2 and 3, which are about vouchers and affirmative action, he talks a lot about what Black people can and have accomplished and how important it is that they not be given barriers, but be given opportunities. And he views some things, as we know, affirmative action as a barrier to great accomplishments by Black Americans. And he views things like vouchers as opportunities. And he believes that vouchers are constitutional, as he says in the Zelman case, and affirmative action is not, as we now know. The Supreme Court has agreed with him, but he said that throughout his career.
Why did the book need to be written now?
That's a great question. So I think it's important to understand kind of how I came about to writing the book. Justice Scalia used to say that it's important we fly the flag of originalism because if we don't, no one else will. We need to explain it. And he used to go in and explain it to lawyers. And when he did, he used to say they used to run out of the room like he was a bear. Well, he changed that. And I think the next step needed to be taken, which is to take originalism to the American people, especially at a time where people are unfairly attacking the courts. I think people need to know what really is going on in the courts. And so what I wanted to do is write a book on originalism. But when I wrote the first few chapters, I gave it to my wife, right? Always a good barometer of what I'm doing. And she basically said, this is so boring, no one will make it through three pages, so start again. So then what I figured out is as I was studying Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas and other ultimate originalists, is that Justice Thomas had this unique voice that has never been captured. And I thought it was important to capture it, but capture it through the real world struggles of the real people involved in the cases.
You acknowledge that there's many different forms of originalism.
Yes.
And you write, quote, Justice Thomas's originalism more often favors the ordinary people who come before the court because the core idea behind originalism is honoring the will of the people. What do you mean by that?
So if you think about the Constitution itself, right, it's written and it is a written document where the American people allowed the federal government and in turn, after the Reconstruction Amendments, the state governments to infringe upon their God-given rights. In minor ways, limited federal government. And in exchange for that, they retained everything else. And the Constitution specifically says that. And the Anti-Federalists didn't believe that the federal government would stay limited. Mm-hmm. And so they insisted on the Bill of Rights and ultimately got the Bill of Rights. But if you look at the words of the document, it often favors ordinary people when properly understood. So take the first chapter, for example. In the first chapter, it's a town not far from the city of New York, New London, Connecticut. Suzette Kilo bought a rundown house. Down on her luck, she bought a rundown house, put her blood, sweat, and tears into making it beautiful. It was so beautiful, she painted it Odessa pink. And while she did this, she lived in this beautiful blue-collar neighborhood. She had a view of the water, which was always her dream. The Pfizer Corporation partnered with the city of New London and the state of Connecticut to take her neighborhood away through a process known as eminent domain. Well, eminent domain, there is a process of eminent domain in the Constitution itself. It's in the Fifth Amendment. It says that the government can take your property for a public use. Those words are important. With just compensation, Justice Thomas explains that public use was originally understood as taking a sliver of your land to widen the road or taking a sliver of your land for a sidewalk that the public would use. In a case in the 1950s, that was changed by the Supreme Court from public use to public purpose. That changed the impact. Suzette and her neighbors, the Dairy family who'd lived there 100 years, their family had loved the neighborhood so much so that when the kids were born, they would put down payments on houses in the neighborhood. We're not going to move. And they wanted to challenge this because it was what they found out is it wasn't for the public use they were taking their land. They were taking their land for an upscale mall and restaurants and other things. So the Pfizer executives had a place to live near their factory, near their lab. And she challenged that all the way to the Supreme Court.
And it was decided not in her favor.
She lost 5-4. Justice Thomas wrote separately. He pointed out that the case that changed it from public use to public purpose was in D.C., and 97% of the people that were displaced were Black. Go find where that's reported, or find where it's reported that Justice Thomas was the one who championed the original meaning, returning it to public use, because when you get away from the original meaning, it's often used to prey on minorities and the poor. And whose invitation did he accept to do that? The NAACP's.
My understanding of originalism, and I grew up in the catechism as well, was that it was a method for interpreting the Constitution, but that methodology would apply sort of impartially to either party. And it feels like what you're saying is that Justice Thomas's strain of originalism sets out to favor one party, i.e. the little guy, over another party.
No, it's the document that favors one party over the other. It favors the individual over government in most instances, not when the government stays in their properly defined role.
The document being the Constitution.
So the Bill of Rights all favor individuals. But the Bill of Rights aren't worth the paper they're written on without the structure of government. That's what's so dangerous about the attacks on different institutions, is if you get one of the government branches, it was set up so they would be co-equals in some sense. And as you weaken one of the branches, you weaken people's ability to vindicate their rights in many sense. You weaken the ability to keep the government in its lane. In other words, force the legislature to do what the legislature is supposed to do. Force the executive to do what the executive is supposed to do.
So you defined your version of originalism as public meaning originalist. What does that mean?
So the easiest way to explain it is the way I explained it to my neighbor, and so maybe I'll do that. So when I was appointed, as you noted, to the Sixth Circuit in 2017, my neighbor heard about it, and he's a dear friend, but he's a businessman, right? He doesn't think about these things. And he read the paper that I was an originalist, and he came running down. Our backyards are adjoined. He came running down, and he said, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe it. You're an originalist. You're one of those people." And I said, "Mike, you're a businessman, right?" "Yes." "You sign contracts, correct?" And he said, "Yeah, I sign contracts all the time." "And you sign contracts with other parties and you put that agreement in writing?" "Yes." "And those words reflect your understanding, what you understood the words to mean at the time when you signed the contract?" He said, "Yeah." "If you have a dispute, when I interpret your contract, should I try to figure out what you all meant? Or should I tell you what I think is best for you, or interpret it how I want to interpret it?" And he said, "Of course you should interpret it by what we all meant at the time we signed it." And I said, "You too are an originalist now. That's all an originalist is doing, is interpreting the document, meaning the Constitution, at the time it was ratified. And as an original public meaning originalist, you're trying to figure out what those words meant to the people that ratified and blessed the document."
How does an originalist deal with the fact that when the document was drafted and most of its amendments were passed, blacks were enslaved, women didn't have the right to vote, men could beat their wives with impunity,
right.
The economy was agrarian, the average flintlock rifle took a minute to reload.
Right.
How does an originalist deal with the fact that we live in a fundamentally different world with, frankly, expanded rights and freedoms now?
Yeah, and so I think that's an important question. I think it's important for a number of reasons. First and foremost, we have to accept. So there's the, dead hand argument. Okay, these are written by the dead hand. What people bring that up, they're afraid of living majorities. That's what Justice Scalia used to say. What that means is if you want to add rights to the document, you can amend it. People say, "Oh, it's too hard to amend the Constitution," but it's been done. The second thing is, if you want to pass laws, Title VII is not in the Constitution, yet it protects us all.
When you say Title VII, you mean Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Yes. Title VII was passed by the legislature. You can pass laws at state level. You can pass at local level. The Constitution isn't the end-all, be-all. So what it does is it defines what we can do, and the rest is left to the American people. And they can decide. The second thing is this argument that, okay, we weren't a part of it. I wasn't a part of it. I didn't get to ratify it. Neither do our kids. And so does the Constitution come anew every time someone turns 18? Do we have to renew it? Because they didn't participate in any of that. Nor did anyone participate that's alive today in the Reconstruction Amendments or the civil rights laws.
So then I think what you're saying is an originalist deals with the fact that the country has changed and has expanded its rights by still interpreting the Constitution that was intended, but also considering how it's been amended and the additional laws that have been passed since then?
Right. So if you bring a suit for discrimination in the workplace, you don't bring it under the Constitution. You bring it under Title VII, right? So you're bringing it pursuant to a law. So the way originalists leave it to the American people to pass laws that they deem necessary to adapt to the changing times. There's a difference between the meaning of the words and the application at the time of the founding. What's important is the meaning of the words.
So when new laws conflict with the original intent of the original laws, how does the originalist understand that?
Well, you can't write a new law to conflict with the Constitution. The Constitution trumps. It says itself, it's supreme. So government can't write a law saying, yeah, we're going to suspend the Fourth Amendment and search everyone's home every Wednesday. The Fourth Amendment doesn't apply. Whether that's good for society or not, they can't do it because the Constitution would trump it.
A conservative lawyer and litigator told me that good lawyers can make an originalist approach to prove many different things. So how narrow is originalism or broad is originalism?
I think that's one thing the People's Justice gets to, right? Is originalism covers a broad area. And I think it's important, if you look at many of criminal defendants' rights in recent time, they came through arguing the original meaning of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. Whether you talk about the sentencing guidelines no longer being mandatory or advisory, the Justice Thomas's expansive view of a right to a jury trial, that affected mandatory minimums in a case known as Alene. He wrote that case, right? That's very pro-criminal defendant. Those cases come because originalism is a concept of interpreting the Constitution that people can argue. You got to prove your case. And I think it's really important that lawyers not only include the arguments they've traditionally included, but include any historical original arguments in their briefs.
Your book was published before the court ruled on the recent affirmative action case.
That's correct.
And this has been an issue that has been critical for Justice Thomas throughout the course of his career on the bench. What is your response to that decision?
Well, I think it's consistent with what he's been saying throughout his career. Justice Thomas has done a few things throughout his career. One thing he's pointed out about affirmative action, and the New York Times just a couple of days ago validated this, is that affirmative action benefited the elites often at the expense of the poor. Recently, as I mentioned, the New York Times said the top 1% of the income bracket most often benefit from all sorts of policies, not only affirmative action, but other policies. What Justice Thomas would always say is, or I'm putting words in his mouth, but the implication of his philosophy is that affirmative action is an unconstitutional band-aid on a much bigger problem. And that bigger problem that we don't fix is the failing public schools. And chapter 2 of the book gets to this in the voucher case in the Cleveland public schools and what a state of disrepair they were in. Mm-hmm. So much so that the kids didn't have soap or toilet paper in their schools and were complaining about it. And what he points out is the reason we need affirmative action is we aren't fixing what Brown v. Board of Education promised these kids, which is giving them the unequal education. They're not getting it. And that's his bigger beef. The other thing he points out is these quote unquote elite schools that everyone wants to get into might not be all they're cracked up to be. And in the sense, and I'm not saying they're not great schools, I think they are great institutions, but he points out that blacks, when they say, oh, we're not going to have black doctors, I think these statistics are from his opinion, but 50% of all black doctors, I think, come from historically black colleges, something he's championed throughout his career. I point out, and I'm sorry, and then I'll stop, but I point out in a case called Missouri v. Jenkins, he said, it never ceases to amaze me that people always assume that anything that's predominantly black is inferior. He's talking about historically black colleges. And so it is amazing to him, 80% of all judges, black judges, went to a historically black college.
40% of black engineers went to a historically black college.
So he's been a champion his whole career for historically black colleges. There again is his strong black voice. And his point is, I don't need someone, you know, he grew up himself in the segregated South. He recognizes that blacks can accomplish, under the hardest circumstances imaginable, incredible things.
Let me ask you, in the affirmative action decision, there seems to be a disagreement between the conservative majority and the minority in the case about the meaning of the 14th Amendment and its due process and equal protection clauses. And the conservative majority, including Thomas, says, quote, eliminating racial discrimination means eliminating all of it. And the minority argue that historical data leaves, quote, no doubt that the equal protection clause permits consideration of race to achieve its goal. Where do you come down?
Well, as a lower court judge, I always come down, no matter the case, with the majority every time, because we have to follow it. We are known as inferior courts. I don't mean that with any disrespect to any of my colleagues, but that's because there is a superior court. So vertical stare decisis, which is a process by which we follow majority opinions, is provided for in the Constitution itself.
So an artful dodge, which is compulsory, I think, from your perspective.
Yes.
But do you recognize that there are these two robust arguments about the meaning of the 14th Amendment?
I think there are robust arguments, but I also think there's precedent, right? So there's the dissent in Plessy, which Justice Thomas points to, by a Kentuckian,
right,
Justice Harlan. There is Brown v. Board of Education. There is what we are talking about when we're talking about precedent. There's also what the original meaning of the 14th Amendment meant. I think it's interesting about that. But one thing Justice Thomas says in Grutter, his dissent in Grutter featured in the book, is imagine a scenario where we said standards have to be higher for this racial group than that, instead of the opposite way. It creates a different set of problems, and it creates a different perspective. And that's what he wants people to think about, I think, when he talks about these things.
And when you say Grutter, you're referring to an earlier decision by the Supreme Court that upheld affirmative action.
Yes. The other thing he constantly comes back to is, in Grutter, mm-hmm, he pointed out that maybe, just maybe, if they got rid of affirmative action, they could achieve diversity, the same diversity, in a number of other ways, including cutting legacy admissions, right? So there are perfectly constitutional ways, in Justice Thomas's mind, to achieve the same thing without stigmatizing minorities.
Justice Thomas joined the majority opinion, but then he also wrote a separate 58-page concurring opinion. Given his personal connection to the issue and his long opposition to it, why do you think he wasn't given the job of writing it?
I don't know the answer to that. That's an inside baseball question that only the Supreme Court justices can tell you the answer to. And my hunch is you can ask all nine and you won't get the answer. I think one thing is he probably wanted to say a lot more than maybe a majority. So one thing the book features is a lot of individual writings. Why? Many people ask me, why does the book feature a bunch of individual writings and not majority opinions by Justice Thomas? The point is, when you write a majority opinion in the courts, you don't only represent your own views, you represent the views of the collective. In other words, the views of all the justices, because they're all going to have their say, they're going to give their feedback, there might be some give and take. I think on issues that are real, that's why I feature 12 separate writings, because I know they're his voice then.
You've spent time studying his voice, and it strikes me that there's something very personal in terms of his own lived experience when it comes to the decision to overturn affirmative action.
So let me ask you this, right? You'll read in the press that he himself benefited from affirmative action. How do we know that? So here's someone who grew up dirt poor in segregated Georgia. I mean, I'm talking dirt poor, so much so that his mom made $10 a week and she had to give up her two sons to their grandfather to raise them. Mm-hmm. He talks about this in his book. Mm-hmm. And then he goes to Holy Cross after a tumultuous childhood and a good childhood, as he himself would say. But I mean, going through the seminary and different things, challenging.
Leaving seminary.
Right. Leaving seminary, finishes ninth in his class.
At
Holy Cross. How do we know that affirmative action? They prove his own theory that the stigma is immediately attached to him. The only reason he is where he is, many people say, is because of the color of his skin.
Well, but if you read his book, you can see that he resents that.
Right.
And so his own lived experience very much, it strikes me, is one that has a negative association or sort of a negative view of affirmative action because of the negative associations that people appropriated to him because he was Black.
And he thinks that happens to many young people and they don't deserve it. In other words, there's many Black students who get to the colleges where they're at.
Yeah.
Through what he believes is a meritorious route. And yet, when people look at them for better or worse, they assume they benefited from affirmative action. And the other point I can't leave is that if these schools would change their standards and or get, as he points out, and I'm just referring to what he points out in Grutter, and get rid of legacy admissions and things like that,
then it would be far more meritorious across the board.
It would be far more meritorious across the board. And that is all he's asking for. He calls them a cognoscenti, meaning the elites. And the elites, he believes, want legacy admissions because they want their own kids to benefit. In his mind, and he's run the numbers, I have not, but if you get rid of legacy admissions, you could achieve a similar rate, not racial balance, because Asians would do much better, I think the statistics prove out, but it would be at the expense of legacy people, not at the expense of other minorities.
So, I mean, I just want to sort of pin down this point. In his concurring opinion, he writes, "I continue to strongly believe and have never doubted that Blacks can achieve in every avenue of American life without the meddling of university administrators."
Said the same thing in Grutter. Same, similar language.
He's quoting himself.
Right.
In his concurring opinion, he is quoting himself from Grutter. So how much should a justice's personal belief and lived experience factor into their decisions?
I think when people say they don't, they're being naive. They definitely factor in, but it doesn't ever trump the original meaning for Justice Thomas. And I think you'll see that throughout the book. I think when you're talking about medical marijuana, right, who would have thought, as one host asked me, that a bunch of conservatives would be championing the right of hippies, although Angel Reich is anything but a hippie and a wonderful woman, but the right to be smoking medical marijuana. And the point is that the original meaning is always going to come first for him. And he's always going to lay out the original meaning as he understands it. But then he's not going to forget about the real people in the case. And he is going to respond when people that he disagrees with, justices he may disagree with, give their lived experience, he's going to give his.
So you said he's going to interpret the original meaning as he understands it. I think originalism then requires justices to have a firm understanding of history.
It requires lawyers to present good arguments of a firm understanding of history if it's a majority, because the majorities are bound by the lawyers' arguments often, at least in the lower courts and even at the Supreme Court to some extent. And then, but yes, when they do historical research, it is a lot of work. I always joke to my clerks, if I wasn't an originalist, they could go home at 3 because I could tell them the answer, but I can't tell them the answer. We got to do the historical research to figure it out if we're doing a separate writing. If we're doing a majority, we're bound by what the lawyers present in some sense. They can forfeit arguments. And so it's a little different than it's the lawyers presenting.
So there was this really interesting back and forth about the Freedmen's Bureau in the affirmative action decisions. Justice Thomas calls the Freedmen's Bureau Acts, which passed after the Civil War, a formally race-neutral category because they also helped impoverished white refugees.
Right.
Historians point out that throughout the period of the 14th Amendment, when it was drafted and ratified, all sorts of race-conscious federal and state statutes were passed that gave special benefits and protections to African Americans. So how do you respond to this critique or this debate about the Freedmen's Bureau? And one of the arguments is that Justice Thomas is frankly cherry-picking history.
Yeah, and I think you just evaluate, that's why you read the opinions. I think you evaluate the weight of evidence on one side and the way, that's the beauty of originalism, right? You have to show your work and people can evaluate, is he right as an original matter? Is he right as a precedential, is the court right as a precedential matter, meaning the chief? Is Justice Thomas right as an original matter? You can agree or disagree, but you can evaluate it at least. And the beauty of originalism and how far it's come is how much of that is now not only in the majorities, but in the dissents.
Yeah. And it's there. One of the dissents was Justice Jackson. Let me read you one quote, which actually addresses the fact that the court says that this affirmative action decision doesn't apply to military academies. The court has come to rest on the bottom line conclusion that racial diversity in higher education is only worth potentially preserving insofar as it might be needed to prepare Black Americans and other underrepresented minorities for success in the bunker, not the boardroom, a particularly awkward place to land in light of the history the majority opts to ignore. To impose this result in that clause's name when it requires no such thing, and to thereby obstruct our collective progress towards the full realization of the clause's promise, is truly a tragedy for us all. What's your reaction?
I would just say I think Justice Jackson has an important point of view that people need to read her and Justice Thomas together. In other words, you can't read one in isolation. You need to read them together and decide, the American people can decide who they think is right. But I think it's better to read them together. And then the other point I come back to is the majority didn't, I think, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think the majority decided the military point. I think they dropped a footnote and specifically said, that's not in front of us. Okay. We are not deciding it. They can't decide something that hasn't been briefed. So they're not going to decide this issue until it comes in front of them.
What do you make of Justice Jackson's almost originalist approach to making her case?
I love that she's engaging on originalism. I tend to think it's a important voice on the court and that she is bringing something to the debate that is healthy for the court as an institution. And the back and forth between Justice Thomas and Justice Jackson is fascinating to me. And it's must reading.
Yeah. There's a lot more of it from Justice Thomas than from Justice Jackson, but she does respond, albeit in a footnote. Here's another originalist question that it'd be great for you to take on for the audience. Originalists used to say that Brown v. Board of Education was wrongly decided. And as recently as 2016, Amy Coney Barrett even wrote that adherence to originalism arguably requires the reversal of Brown v. Board of Education. But there's also an alternative argument where originalists have flipped, arguing that the 14th Amendment, in its original understanding, forbade the segregation of public schools. Explain how that argument works.
So what I would say to that is I would encourage people to read Michael McConnell's piece. He's got a long piece in the Virginia Law Review about why Brown was right as an original matter, and I think a shorter version of that in the Harvard Law Review, where he goes through all the historical data. The long piece in Virginia, I think, is like 170 pages long, where he justifies and believes that Brown is right as an original matter. The other thing I would encourage people to read, although the People's Justice, of course, comes first, is Simple Justice. And it's a book about Thurgood Marshall's crusade to overturn Plessy. And I think it's a masterful litigation technique book, as well as an amazing story about how great a litigator Thurgood Marshall was. But the one thing Thurgood Marshall did that people forget is he didn't try to change the meaning. He changed the underlying factual assumptions about what was equal.
On the original firing line, the host, William F. Buckley Jr., had a back and forth with the very liberal California Governor Jerry Brown about whether the Supreme Court ought to even be weighing in on the nation's social problems. This discussion takes place in 1975, and the specific social issue being discussed here is busing.
In this situation, I think the courts can handle it. I think the accumulated wisdom that is certainly accumulating will make its weight in the U.S. Supreme Court, and I prefer to
leave there. But the Supreme Court is not a legislative body. I didn't think you would go so far as to say that we ought to permit the Supreme Court to relieve Congress of its essential responsibilities. As the Supreme Court itself told us for a period of a century, that some problems are legislative and political in character, others are judicial, and I'm surprised that because you shrink from asking the legislature to do what you think ought to be done, that you somehow hope that nine justices of the Supreme Court
Well, first of all,
to
try to define with simplicity the difference between legislative and judicial isn't really possible. Certainly, I thought that that was the place where many of these things could be corrected, and I'm beginning to have some question about the wisdom of the isolated judiciary arrogating to themselves so many of the social problems of our time.
Mm-hmm. Today, there are issues like affirmative action, abortion, voting rights, presidential power. Is it fair to say that Congress has become so stuck against the backdrop of hyper-partisanship that there has been an over-reliance on the court?
So I'm not going to weigh into the political issues, but what I would say is I think it's important that all of the government branches stay in their lanes. Why? That leaves the power in the American people. So there's certain things the Constitution takes away that the government can't do, right? And that is what the Constitution lays out. What Justice Scalia used to say is, what's left? He'd rather have 9 people randomly chosen from the phone book decide than the 9 people in the building. And he was somewhat joking, but what he meant is that the American people get to decide the important issues of the day that aren't in the Constitution, and they get to decide them through their elected representatives. Whether that's in Washington, we always point to Washington, but we should remember, as my colleague Jeff Sutton says, there's also 50 state governments and 1 other government in the District of Columbia, 51 other governments that can decide these things.
We can't really have a conversation about Justice Thomas without touching on this piece of news. You wrote the People's Justice, and the People's Justice was published before the recent wave of articles about Justice Thomas's financial disclosures and gifts and trips that were paid for by wealthy friends. What is your reaction to that reporting?
What I would say is a couple things. One is that there's a lot of attacks right now on the court as an institution. I know almost all of the justices, and I would say that they are people of integrity, first and foremost. The second thing is you can judge justice. The beauty of the People's Justice is you can read the book. You can see what he says. You can see if he's being consistent. Justice Thomas is friends with everyone. Everyone he meets is his friend. Even if he meets a critic and spends 10 minutes with them, they become a friend of his. Every time I tell stories about Justice Thomas personally, I hear other stories from other people. I'll tell stories about how we were late for a dinner because we were at a reception and we had to escort him to the dinner. And he spent 30 minutes after that thanking all the support staff, taking pictures with them, talking to them until they were done. He makes friends with everyone he meets. As soon as I tell that story somewhere, or I start talking about the homeless person he befriended in the book. As soon as you tell that story, from someone who's met him, you hear another story just like it. There isn't a person he hasn't met. It doesn't matter if you're his biggest critic. If he meets you, he's going to be friendly and befriend you.
In a recent New York Times op-ed, the federal judge Michael Ponser wrote that the justices have failed to avoid, quote, conduct with a dubious aroma. He isn't just talking about Justice Thomas. He cites Justice Alito's travel, Justice Sotomayor using court staff to promote her books, and even Justice Ginsburg, who didn't recuse herself from cases involving her husband's law firm. Would it be helpful if the U.S. Supreme Court followed the same formal ethical guidelines that are imposed upon you and the rest of the judges in this country?
That's up to them. I don't tell my bosses what to do, but I would challenge on any of those justices, any of the ones you just mentioned, anyone to point out where they've ruled inconsistent with their priors as a result of any of that. And they haven't. None of them have. Not Justice Ginsburg, not Justice Sotomayor, not Justice Thomas, not Justice Alito. They've all ruled in their cases consistent with their priors. You can track their record. You can analyze their record. Their rulings, when you read them, you will understand why they're ruling the way they are. And it has to do with the case or controversy in front of them. Whether they decide, what they decide, the Chief and Justice Kagan, I think, have spoken about this, and I would defer to them.
While the justices may not have done anything illegal, is the appearance of impropriety damaging to the court?
I think the constant attacks on the institution don't help, and it's important that judges talk about, look, I've got an amazing court. I've got 15 other colleagues, some active judges, some of who agree with me, some who disagree with me. What I would say is I would defend any of them. They're amazing people. I wish everyone functioned like the courts. We disagree without being disagreeable. We decide some of the most important issues, sometimes heatedly, but we're friends. And we recognize afterwards that we all want what's best for the country. I think the same thing happens at the court. I think it's an amazing institution that is doing its job every day, and no one can point to a case that was impacted in any way by any of these things.
But you can see that the appearance of impropriety hurts the court.
I definitely see that the appearance hurts, and I think it's important that we, as judges and justices, be more open about what goes on inside the institution. In other words, that we work together, that we have good relationships, that we try our best to get cases right.
What do you mean by increasing transparency about how the court works?
That we talk about it. Not like what's going on in a particular case, but that we talk about that, hey, you know, I have disagreements with my colleagues without being disagreeable. We work hard to reach consensus when we can. Everyone wants to report on the 5-4 or 6-3 decisions. Go look how many were 9-0. How many of those are reported on, or 8-1 or 7-2? And how many had what quote unquote strange ideological bedfellows, for whatever that's worth? I mean, there's a large majority, probably 80%, 90% of the cases. And yet everyone wants to focus on the small few. I understand why. But my point is that we work really hard to try and get cases right. And that's true of everyone I've experienced in the court system, whether I agree with them or disagree with them. They're working their hardest. And I think what goes on inside the courts is a really, in my experience, a very positive thing.
There was an unprecedented leak at the Supreme Court in the Dobbs decision. As a judge in a lower court, how did that impact you?
It didn't. It hasn't happened anywhere else that I'm aware of.
I mean, but that sent massive tremors through the circuits. For anybody who watches the court, it was a really disturbing event.
I think the breach of trust was disturbing, but that's my point. It was disturbing because it happened, because it's so rare. Isn't that amazing? I mean, that's a great thing that it's rare, that none of these breaches of trust rarely happen in our institution.
What does it tell you that it did happen?
It was unprecedented.
I mean, are there things that need to be fixed at the highest court?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't studied it. I'm sure the chief is paying close attention and has taken into account what happened and it seems to me rectified whatever went on.
I feel like it's not rectified because there is an inconclusive determination about what happened.
Well, but what I would say is it hasn't happened again, and that's what's important, I think. I understand what you're saying, and they're trying to figure that out as far as I know, or they haven't figured it out.
You were interviewed by President Trump for at least 2 vacancies on the Supreme Court, maybe 3. And you're likely to be considered by a future Republican president for an opening on the court. What would you bring to the Supreme Court?
Oh, I'm happy where I'm at. I think it's important that people enjoy what they're doing and not worry about the next step. And I love what I do, so I'm not going to worry about that. I don't know. You know, there's a lot of amazingly qualified people that they can pick, and I don't know that I am on that list, and so I'd leave that.
What was it like to be interviewed by President Trump?
You know, for a kid who's the child of immigrants, my dad came here. He grew up dirt poor, single mom in India. His dad passed away when he was 2. A one-way ticket and a $5 bill is what he got from his mom. He was the one of 5 kids that she could afford to send to America and said, make something of yourself. I watched my parents get naturalized. I now get to naturalize citizens. It was an incredible honor to go to the White House as the child of immigrants, be appointed 3 different times by presidents. I mean, only in America can things like this happen. Only in America can a kid rise from being dirt poor in the segregated South to being a justice on the Supreme Court. And so when we get to go there, It's an amazing honor.
Justice Thomas is the longest serving Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. He's served almost 32 years. He will be retiring at some point. You've just written a book about him. Does this book make you a logical candidate to be his successor?
No. And I don't think Justice Thomas is going to retire anytime soon. I think he has a lot more that he can offer the country, and I think he's going to continue to do that.
Judge Amul Thapar, thank you for joining me here on Firing Line, and thank you for sharing the people's justice with us.
Thank you for having me.